This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Just as slavery was once described as the South's peculiar institution, race has always been a peculiar problem for this country. Even those who believe themselves not to have a prejudiced bone in their body can often be challenged by race. Those same people might even pride themselves on being colorblind. Debbie Irving did. Yet despite her best efforts to reach across the divide, she couldn't. Not until she realized she needed to examine the role being white plays in understanding race. For her, it was a long journey of discovering just what it means to be white and understanding the full implications of the privilege that comes with it. She's written a book about all this, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. She joins us for the hour along with Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., who in 1996 started America and More in order to provide more comprehensive diversity, privilege, and leadership training and workshops for schools, community groups, and businesses. He's also the founder of the White Privilege Conference, the latest of which just wrapped up in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for having us, Mike. I'm excited.
Good. Actually, neither of them are here. Dr. Moore is in Brooklyn, New York, and Debbie Irving is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You just participated, Debbie, I understand, in that White Privilege Conference in Wisconsin. Before you wrote your book, did you know such conference? Because this has been going on for 15 years now. Did you know such conferences existed?
Absolutely not. And I would have been at the first one if I knew it existed. Because I have long been thinking about race, I just had no idea how to approach learning about it. And I entered the white privilege scene about 5 years ago. So this was not my first, the one last week. And the White Privilege Conference is where I've done a lot of my very important learning and connecting with the people who helped me understand the way racism operates and operates in my life. Those were the people who really mentored me over the last 5 years.
Mm. We'll talk about Debbie's personal journey through all of this in a minute, but Eddie Moore, she is white, you're black, you started this conference. Is that fact part and parcel of what the problem is, that you recognize white privilege and a lot of white people do not?
Well, I wouldn't say that I was at an enlightening stage in which I was recognizing this white privilege thing, you know, growing up myself. I think I knew a little bit about, you know, race and racism and race relations and some of the conflict associated with that. But it was until I was in my PhD program that I really got, you know, challenged with this concept of white supremacy, white privilege as a philosophical belief, and really how it impacted the way systems and institutions were designed and how, of course, systems and institutions impact individuals' behaviors and the cycle continues. And so after learning that, it was then I thought, man, we need to have a place where we can keep having this conversation because I had no idea and wasn't really engaging this subject matter at that level. I was doing some race stuff and race relations stuff, but really not looking at the concept of power and privilege, and that's really how the conference got started.
Do you ever get pushback from people about this notion of white privilege? I mean, about this conference that you've designed that's devoted to it that you have every year? Do people give you grief over that?
Yeah, Mike, we usually get three levels of pushback. You know, we get just general people saying, what is this thing? To people who are, you know, assuming that it's about making white people feel bad and beating and attacking white people. And then on the third level, we get some real, you know, threats and some ugly stuff that comes from some folks that are really, you know, not in any way trying to do anything positive, I think, when it comes to having a difference of opinion. So absolutely, there's pushback every year, and it's usually at those three levels.
Is this a difficult thing for us to talk about, for white people to talk about, Debbie?
Well, that's my goal in life, is to make it not so uncomfortable. And what held me back for so long is that I feel like I was part of what I call the epidemic of silence amongst white people when it comes to talking about race and racism. And part of it is a lack of experience. I grew up in a household where race was never mentioned. And in, you know, in my social life, it was never mentioned. And so when you go to talk about it, we're missing language, we're missing history, and we're missing a comfort level. It feels like I was terrified of being called a racist or saying something offensive or embarrassing myself. Truthfully, that was a part of it. But none of that needs to be. It's just a matter of practice. I was thinking just recently, you know, it's so interesting. Most Americans can engage in conversations about basic nutrition, you know, good fats versus bad fats. Most Americans can engage in conversation about climate change, you know, why it's being created, what the debate around it is. Most white Americans, I might even extend this to most Americans, can't even come up with a common definition of racism. So often we're not even talking about the same thing. And so what I really felt was missing was a 101 book for white people to get the basics so that we're at least starting with some common understandings in order to engage in the conversation.
How would you define racism?
Well, a common definition is, let me say what it isn't. Racism is not prejudice. It involves prejudice. But for so long, I thought racism meant not liking a person of color. So therefore, I couldn't be racist. But if you think about prejudice, because prejudice is a level playing field, anyone can, you know, hold prejudice towards anyone else. What ups it to racism is the ingredient of power. So yes, there's prejudice between groups, but white people have been the only group to take their prejudice and add power to it and create policies around it. I mean, slavery is the most obvious and blatant institution, but it happens in much more subtle ways even today.
And how would you define racism, Dr. Moore?
Yeah, I think for me, racism is really prejudice plus power, and how someone takes a bias, which we all have, or prejudice against groups, which we all possess. Everybody has bias. Everybody has prejudice. But when you have the resources, the systemic or institutional backing to institute policy or decisions based on those biases and prejudice, that's when it becomes racism. The same in the case of sexism and some of the other kind of oppressive factors that are continuing in our society. I wanted to also just quickly add that Debbie sparked in me is really this concept about skills. And I think for me, that's really a big part of what the work needs in the 21st century and why this book is so important is our kids can't grow up like we grew up, where they're going to be having the luxury of ignorance, as I like to call it, so that they don't have to engage in these topics. And I think the more materials we can begin to produce so that young people in the 21st century can begin to have some at least basic skills to be able to just ask questions or engage each other around these subject matter, I think it's going to make them better prepared for a fast-changing, multicultural, global world.
It is my impression, and it could be very wrong, that we have made amazing strides in all of this since 1968, and certainly since the 1950s. Would that be incorrect?
Well, it depends on how you look at it, Mike. I think you can't deny the fact that we have a multiracial president in the White House after 40-something presidents that look the same, pretty much being white and male, that's not a sign of progress. So I think there's absolutely some signals that, you know, are showing us signs that, you know, progress has been made. I mean, the fact that we're on this show together as a diverse group of people, I mean, some places this didn't really happen or couldn't happen. So there are some things that are happening. But for me, I think some of this stuff is basic human treatment. The fact that, you know, if we were all in the same town and we went to breakfast after this conversation, we wouldn't be killed or we wouldn't be ran out of the restaurant. I mean, I think that's a sign of progress, but that's like basic human treatment. We can have coffee in a restaurant and not die. What I think is really important when I gauge progress is power. And I think when you look at where power sits in the 21st century, it still looks consistently to what it looked like, I think, in the 20th century and 19th century. And I think that's part of what we're trying to look at is power when we're talking about progress as well.
Mm. Part of the problem, I think, of having any conversation about race, at least for white people, it seems, is that the stakes are really high because it would be very easy out of ignorance or insensitivity or a slip of the tongue to say something wrong or insensitive. You bring something up in your book that kind of leapt off of page 127 to me, Debbie, when you talk about being at a meeting and a coach was talking about a child, an African-American child, and he mentioned that the child was articulate. And the mother jumps up and says, "What do you mean my son is articulate?" And I have had this experience myself. I was interviewing a young woman who was exceedingly bright and articulate. And I said, you know, you're really articulate. It was just a complete, it was a compliment. And she took umbrage at it on the air. Evidently, articulate's a code word.
I think it's become a code word. And the case that you're talking about, that when that coach called that young boy articulate, he hadn't even spent 2 minutes with him. He was a black boy touring a predominantly white private school. And the coach immediately assumed that the guy was going to be an excellent football player. And the mother, when the mother came into the situation after the coach had been with the boy for 2 minutes, and he said, "I love your son. He's so articulate." The mother said, you know, you've barely spent 2 minutes with him. And the other thing the coach said was, "We're so excited to have him on our football team." And she said, "Have you spoken to any of his football coaches? Have you watched any of his tapes? Do you even know? Or are you making these assumptions that, A, he's a good football player because he's a black male? And by saying that he's articulate, it's almost implying that it's a surprising thing for a young black male to be able to string a sentence together."
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard what the young man had said. He sounded like a teenager. You know, I don't think if my white daughter had said that, any would have said, "Ooh, she's articulate."
Mm.
So that's it. It does become, and this is why it's so important to be able to talk about it, because if there's a word or a concept that is hurting any population, be it women or people of color, if the impact lands on them in a way that's hurtful, and when they try to say, "Please don't use this word. Here's how it feels to me," if the people that they're trying to convey that to aren't listening, stereotypes get reinforced.
But how do you have that conversation if the landscape is full of landmines?
Oh, well, first you read my book. And it really comes down to, I think what's very hard, I know that I, as a white person, I was really taught to, you know, act like I had my act together, and making myself vulnerable or revealing that there were things I didn't know, that was like emotionally, just in my gut, a very hard thing to do. And so to get into these conversations, if a person of color calls me on something, I know now the first thing I do is I just listen and I think, wow, this is a moment to learn. It's not a moment to defend myself and say, "I didn't mean it that way." So I think not taking things personally and understanding there's a real distinction between intention, no matter how good your intention is, the impact can be hurtful. And to just believe that, and there's a lot of accusation on people of color of being overly sensitive. And I would say that really it's about, in my case, I was undersensitive. By being defensive, which has happened to me several times, I sent a signal to the person I was trying to have a friendship or a work relationship with that, you know, I don't hear your problem and it can't be real.
I only have 40 seconds left, Dr. Moore, but on the other side of this conversation, are there problems on the other side just as there are problems on our side?
Absolutely. I think I can speak to that personally, that, you know, again, I did not grow up with the skills to have these conversations. And some of the things that I grew up around, my views and my perspectives were unhealthy as well. So I think for me, when you think about this landmine metaphor, it's all about practice. I mean, you're going to stumble a little bit. You're going to trip a little bit. But I think the more you have practice doing it, the better you'll become at it.
We're talking about race with Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., founder of the White Privilege Conference, which we'll talk more about, and Debbie Irving, a racial justice educator and author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds from their own diamond cutters in Tel Aviv, including rare colored diamonds and fancy cut diamonds from 1 carat to 10 carats, Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, diamonds-direct.com. And Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, certified public accountants, helping companies achieve their financial goals with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas, BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. For 20 years, CPCC's literary festival, Sensoria, has hosted giants and up-and-coming literary figures from around the world. This year, they welcome Richard Blanco, who was the poet for President Obama's 2013 inauguration, and North Carolina's 7th Poet Laureate. And both men will join us in advance of the festival tomorrow at 9. And then a new way for young people to become a rock musician. every parent's dream. Tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a chemical leak that tainted West Virginia's water supply and a mudslide that killed dozens in Washington state, new questions about the role of private industry and environmental regulations.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Debbie Irving, our guest, racial justice educator, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is the founder of the White Privilege Conference. They both join us by phone this morning from various different locations around the country. You know, a lot of people, when they hear the term white privilege, might be bristling because they know people, or maybe they themselves are struggling to make it. They don't feel privileged at all. They may see this really more as a struggle between the haves and have-nots and not between black and white. What do you say to them? And I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of. Maybe Eddie.
Eddie started the conference. Okay. I think he should answer that.
Okay.
Well, you know, I think, again, it's great that you have the two of us here because the way we respond to people could be very different, may need to be very different, and I think often it depends on who you're talking to. If I'm talking to someone who's genuinely, you know, trying to engage that question, then I'm going to sit down and have some conversations and be acknowledging the fact that the reality that they're expressing where there's not this feeling of privilege is real for them, but also trying to demonstrate that as a man, I mean, I work hard. I've come through some tough times to get all the stuff that I've obtained through my success and all of that based on my neighborhood. But none of that has anything to do with the fact that when I step into the store or onto the car lot with Debbie, I'm going to receive a certain perk or privilege as a man that she's not going to receive. And so I think there's a reality of a system, of an organization, of an institution that we're living in, that we're operating in, often as individuals across this nation, particularly America, that has to do with the way the systems were designed and the ways in which it favored groups of people and how those realities still exist today, no matter how hard times are for you, no matter how hard you worked and all that kind of stuff. There's just certain perks and benefits you receive simply because you're male, simply because you have white skin, simply because as we're on the phone talking right now, there's a certain hearing privilege that we have, an ability privilege that we have. So I think that's the other piece that I would echo, is that the conversation of privilege is not just about skin-based privilege. Everybody has privilege, and we're all affected by it in very different ways. And I think the conversation allows us to be, I think, more in tune to the challenges, but also the ability and possibility of building relationships so we can make a better world for everybody.
Mm. I don't mean to accuse you of tap dancing around the answer, but I'm wondering if you answered the question. Because if you are living in poverty in a trailer park, or you're living in a shanty in a holla in West Virginia, and you're barely able to feed your family, but your skin is white, you still have it over your African-American compatriots who maybe have a middle-class job, really?
Oh, no. I would say then that what you really need to do when you start examining, like Eddie said, we are all a blend of privilege and lack of privilege, advantage and disadvantage. And when you tease apart the skin color piece, you have to hold everything else, all those other privileges, constant. So if you're going to compare, you know, and there's a whole underclass of white Americans in this country. And so this is, conversation has gotten much more complicated and I would argue much more important. But if you're going to take a look at at white privilege in people who are living in impoverished conditions, you would want to compare it to black Americans or, you know, any other population of color living in impoverished conditions. So you would need to hold that piece constant. And I would say, you know, that for me, I grew up in New England, upper middle class, and so it was really hard for me to untangle my class privilege from my white privilege, which is something I had to do, and I do explain that in the book. But the thing that white skin privilege gets you, everyday lack of stress in that you're not being followed when you go into a store. You can drive down the highway, you know, if you can afford a car, you can go down the highway without being stopped. And then there are huge pieces. So, for instance, through history, white people were the first people to get citizenship, which also meant being able to vote, being able to own land. And I think of it sometimes as a monopoly game, and that the white people just had this huge head start. And then every other group who, you know, fought for and eventually got citizenship rights came in late to the game. And one of the ways that I interpreted what I saw and what I saw as, you know, in the Boston area was I saw that white people were living in the better houses, had the better jobs. You know, they just seemed to be happier and achieving more. And when I contrasted that to the black population in Boston, you know, what the conclusions I drew was that white people were actually, you know, biologically superior. I bought into that, which is a very outdated scientific understanding.
How long ago was that?
Well, I was born in 1960. I grew up, no one ever said that to me. This is the other thing. In the absence of a household, in the absence of conversation about race, I got all these little snippets through the media, and I put it together in my imagination, and I have discovered that millions of white Americans my age have done the exact same thing, and that it's really hard then to start to recognize, as Eddie was talking about, these biases, that these are biases that I was taught, and they aren't necessarily real, which is why being able to get the skills to have the conversations to make real relationships cross-racially is one of the most powerful ways to start to demyth who we have living in this country.
So cues through the media, but also people, I think, leaping to their own conclusions because they don't have the information that they need to reach the accurate conclusion is part of the problem. Yes?
Yes, and I'll give you a great example. My dad was a musician and an athlete in college, and he continued to play around with both, even though he was ended up becoming a lawyer. And he always had jazz playing in the house, and he was always watching sports on TV. And he said, you know, probably a couple times in my entire childhood, he said, "Wow, those Negroes can jump," or "Wow, those Negroes have great rhythm." So I took those tiny snippets of information, and I made the assumption that if black people could jump and were good athletes, that white people must not be. And if black people had great rhythm, white people must not. That there was a distinction being made, and somehow it applied to everybody who had that skin color. And that was one drop in it's like a sponge. That was one drop that started to saturate this sponge that was my brain, and I constructed an understanding of who people were according to skin color that was just not correct.
I know that this is not the first time you've heard these things, Dr. Moore, but because you are here representing the entire African-American group of people, what has been the reaction in the community to statements like that?
Yeah, you know, there are times when I don't mind speaking for every black person in America, and maybe this is one of those times, but I think you know, again, this issue of privilege and why it has to be expanded beyond race-based privilege is because, again, some of those challenges are going on even in the black community. So when you're, again, asking me about white privilege, I think I used to think all of these issues were just about white people, like they were the problem. They were the issue, and when they get it together, things would be so much better. But I was not realizing, you know, even for myself, some of the challenges that were going on for me psychologically when you're, you know, not seeing yourself in these privileged positions, when you're not seeing yourself have access, or, you know, beginning to internalize that maybe this is as far as you can go is through or to this level in an organization or through sports. And I think the thing that's happening in the black community that I see that I'm concerned about connected to the conference, that is a part of the conference and some of the challenge we're trying to do at the conference, is some of that psychological piece. And I think it also attaches to what Debbie's saying, is it really prevents us from having multicultural, I think, productive, solid relationships, so that if we're truly committed to building a society of equity and justice, it has to be done in a way that's multicultural, I think, diverse. And so I think for me, some of the challenges is with some of that internalized hate for white people, thinking that they got everything. They got it. So it's like people just poured stuff on you as soon as you came into the world. And it built up such animosity inside of me towards white folks that I wasn't allowed to build healthy, productive relationships. And I think that's part of what we try to look at and what's, I think, some of what's going on in the people of color, black people particularly, specifically neighborhoods, and with people at the conference as well.
As I understand it, Debbie, as an adult, you made it a point to try to make professional and personal relationships with people of other races. And you say you worried about offending people that you dearly wanted to befriend, and you didn't understand why your efforts were not bearing fruit. What does that mean? Were you completely unsuccessful in developing these relationships?
No, as a matter of fact, I had several friends of color who have been friends for years, but there was just, they weren't the friends I would pick to go on a vacation with or someone I would call in the middle of the night for a favor. There was something, as I call it, there was an elephant in the room. And I'm wondering, I'm going to try to connect a couple things here. So when you heard me talk about things my father said about Negroes can jump, and, you know, my siblings, when they first started to read my book, were like, isn't this going to be hard? Aren't people of color, aren't you going to hurt their feelings by admitting this stuff? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, in a cross-racial friendship, talking about what's going on for us psychologically ends up being important. It ends up not only being not offensive, but that sharing is part of the richness. And, you know, it doesn't mean you go out and you start a friendship by saying, hey, I used to think blah, blah, blah. But it, as the friendship deepens, it really is a way to educate one another about, because we've been living very different experiences in the same country, and helping each other understand these experiences. And that's what the White Privilege Conference is for.
Is this just America? Is this a problem in England where African Americans have a role in their society as well? Is it a problem in all societies where people of different races mix? Or is it particular to America?
You want to take a turn, Eddie?
Well, I think the issue of what I would call white supremacy, white cultural dominance, white male dominance, that philosophical belief, I don't think is unique to America. I think what makes America unique is somewhat its role in the enslavement of African people and how that took place across hundreds of years in our society and its impact on even present-day conditions, I think. I think some of the elements of how white supremacy, white male dominance played out in our society are unique. But I think the common thread I find in the UK and maybe even in other places across the globe is this thread of white supremacy, white superiority, white male dominance, white cultural dominance. And I think that's often, Mike, something that, I mean, you can't even say in front of people without them, you know, looking at you or feeling horrifically offended that you would call them a white supremacist, all that kind of stuff. And that's what we're trying to shift. Again, I'm not saying you got to buy this or you got to say that Dr. Moore is 100% right, but can we at least begin to have some conversation that include not only racism, not only sexism, not only oppression for all these groups of folks, but also what I think is kind of the birthplace of all of that, which is white supremacy, white male dominance, white cultural dominance.
You wrote that Debbie's book opens a rare window on how white Americans are socialized and may lead white readers to reconsider the roots of their own perspectives, while readers of color will no doubt find the view through Debbie Irving's window fascinating and telling. How so?
That was actually Van Jones who said that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have.
Yeah.
That was pretty good, though.
Yeah. Maybe I should have just kept my mouth shut. Yeah. I guess one thing I would add, not to get away from that, but I am going to get away from that. One of the things that I think is unique to America and racism in America is this country was started, or, you know, I won't even get into the fact that what happened with the indigenous people already living here, the white people who brought to America an idea of democracy and a level playing field and a meritocracy, that's the American ideal. That's the American promise. And what racism has done is it's obstructed Are we all here?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, it's obstructed that promise. We can't get to it because racism and white supremacy, as Eddie is saying, is standing in our way. White supremacy is a word I don't use a lot in conversations because so many people connect it to neo-Nazism and skinheads, KKK. But white supremacy, I personally am comfortable with that term because it simply means as a white person, I thought I was superior.
But isn't the truth that the founding of this country and the democracy that the founding fathers saw was not for white people, it was for white men who happened to own land. Women weren't considered, African Americans were not considered, nobody else was considered. Isn't that really the truth of it all?
I think so. And I will just come clean and say, that's my ancestry. My family came over on those early boats. And somehow, even with all that history coming down through my family, that part of it never got spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
It was all the good intention.
Yeah, and I don't know if those two statements are very different, Mike. I mean, I think you're right, and I would agree. And I think most and the average person who knows much about America's history would agree. And I think the question that I have and what we're trying to grapple with the conference, but also I think what Debbie does a great job of grappling with, and it alludes to what Van Jones was writing about, is really this foundation in which we learned the world, in which we begin to see the world, in which we begin to understand people. And that was very different for people of color than it was for white people. And these white men, as we named them in the Founding Fathers, believed in and often wrote about white male dominance, white male supremacy. And so if they established the institution, the systems, and organizations on that philosophy, I think it's important for us to understand the years in which that was consistent. Now, of course, we've had some changes and some movement and some challenges, but I think what we're trying to do is say, is there still some element? I mean, in 2014, do you still run into people who think like it's 1914? And I think that trying to get a sense of how this systemic design, this organizational design from years ago still has an impact today is really the important piece that I think projects like Debbie's and what we're trying to do at the conference is all about.
Do you really? Do you run into people who think it's 1914 or who talk like it's 1914 or who think like it's 1914?
Oh, I think I'm a classic example. Best intentions in the world. I had spent my 25-year career trying to bridge the racial divide. And yet what I never recognized was that I was trying to help and fix people who I saw as less than me. And I didn't understand that that's what my motivation was because I wasn't in touch with this deeply embedded philosophy. And when you grow up in a society that has a philosophy, you can't help but adopt it yourself. And that was shocking to me.
I want to find out about your aha moment that you had in 2009, which led you to change what you do and how you approach this conversation in just a couple of seconds. And then I want to share a lot of things that have come in over the transom as we've been talking from our listeners here. But coming right back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Center for Aortic Disease, providing comprehensive treatments for all aortic diseases. Information at uncaortic.com. And Duke University's Master of Management in Clinical Informatics program, a one-year master's program offered on weekends for working professionals. Accepting applications for August class start, dukemmci.org. A chemical leak that tainted West Virginia's water supply and a mudslide that killed dozens in Washington state are raising new questions about the role of private industry and environmental regulations. That topic will be taken up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation about race, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start. We're coming right back.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Duncan McFadden. Thanks for inviting us into your home on weekend mornings.
Stay in your PJs. We'll still take you all around the world for the news and introduce you to some fascinating people who'll make you understand something, see something anew, or just plain laugh.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR and WFAE. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Dr. Eddie Moore also with us, the founder of the White Privilege Conference. You had an aha moment when you realized all these things about yourself that you were doing that were not productive and were not leading to solid friendships or even professional relationships with that you really could count on. And you had this aha moment in 2009, Debbie Irving. What was it?
Well, I'm going to keep everyone in suspense for a minute, because what we were talking about right before the break is so critical, and it's such a part of the heart. It's at the heart of what Eddie and I are both so passionate about. And I just wanted to check in with Eddie and see if he had anything he wanted to add.
Oh, 1914, Mike. I just wanted to, because I think one of the things that the Obama presidency has showed us, or President Obama in the White House, is even though this gentleman has all these qualifications, and again, people may disagree with him policy-wise. In fact, there's some things I may disagree at times with him policy-wise, but the depiction of him across some of the caricatures and the ways in which he's been described, and even his wife have been referenced to in these kind of, 1920 cartoons, I think, is a sign of how in 2014 we still have people thinking like it's 1914. Even some of the ways in which we saw people participating in the reelection campaign and some of the things that they were putting out there, I think that's another example. And then I can send you a list of comments, Mike, that we've received in reference to the conference that, again, just raises some concern for me that in 2014, we still have people thinking like it's 1914, which I think connects to the fact of and to what Debbie is trying to do in the book, is demonstrate how systemically, institutionally, we're still conditioned by those old patterns of behavior that were established hundreds of years ago.
I think we've come to the conclusion that the election of Barack Obama did not put us into a post-racial society, as many people believed it was an indication of. And I think a lot of the things that you talk about that have happened since then, a lot of the obstructionism, et cetera, has been part and parcel of the fact that he is an African-American president and not just a Democratic president. But he's been in office for 6 years. A lot of people hoped that he would have opened a conversation on race. He has chosen so far really not to. Maybe we should take it upon ourselves. Is that what you've done here?
I think President Obama and the Obama presidency has given us absolutely a platform to have this conversation. But I think for me, and what I like to also add that's important, is it also allows for some personal responsibility and challenges to young black males, which I think is important. That's a whole nother show. But I do think that there are a number of opportunities that the President Obama President Obama being in the White House presents to us as a society. But I just wanted to point out that in addition to that, the way it's not just the post-racial kind of belief that people have, it's the way that they've characterized them and talked about them and described them, and sometimes even ran ads and cartoons about him and his wife. I think that's the piece that I wanted to allude to that still shows us that in 2014, one of the most educated, powerful men in the world is still depicted in these barbaric ways.
So let's get back to Debbie Irving's aha moment in 2009. What made the light bulb go off?
Well, this is interesting, and it wasn't one. That's clever marketing to get people to buy the book. One aha moment in a subject that's in a subject that is this vast. There were many, many aha moments, but certainly there was a turning point for me, and that was that in January of 2009, which was the year that Barack Obama's. That was when I started my course, either a couple days before or a couple days after Barack Obama's first inauguration. And it was when a lot of his cartoons were coming out. And I took a class for a graduate school called Racial and Cultural Identity. And the course asked me, and here I had spent 25 years as a nonprofit manager and then as a classroom teacher, race in my face every day in ways I couldn't understand it. So I was taking this course with the hope of learning about other people's culture so that I could better serve them. in the first class, the professor said, this is going to be hard, one of the hardest things you ever had to do because you're going to examine your own racial identity. And in this class, it was a racially mixed class. And so here I was, one of the white people, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because I didn't even know at that point. This is 2009. This is not that long ago. Despite the fact I had considered myself, I was on diversity committees, no one had ever asked me to examine my race or my racial identity. And I think I didn't even think white was a race. I knew to check it off on the census, but I had no idea the extent to which being white had influenced my life experiences or my perspective. And so that, the big ha-ha was a six-month aha. Within that, there was one moment that really like made me sick to my stomach and made me start shaking and make me understand on a very personal level, and that was learning about the GI Bill. The GI Bill was something I had heard about my whole life. My dad was a World War II vet, as were my uncles and many of the men in the community, this white suburb I grew up in, and I had only heard about it in glowing terms. What I did not realize was that of the there were 1 million black GIs. I didn't even know that there were black men, Americans, who fought in the war, for starters, because they're not depicted in any of the films or history books I read. And I certainly didn't know that those men were not, that they were shut out of the GI Bill. And, you know, the GI Bill for my family meant that, you know, and this, we're not talking 17th, 18th century. This is 1940s, 50s, 60s. My family bought a house with the GI Bill. My dad went to law school on the GI Bill. And, you know, what a financial leg up. And when my parents passed away, the house that they bought had gone from, you know, they bought it for $17,000, they sold it for $1 million. And that was pure equity that got passed on to my siblings and me when my parents died. And, you know, I used to be, by the way, I voted Republican many times in my life because I was passionate about small government. When I started to realize the extent to which big government, like the GI Bill and like land grants, had infused my family with land and money, I started to think differently about what big government means and what small government means and who was getting what. And so when I learned about the GI Bill that night, I actually didn't go home. I called my husband. I said, I can't come home. And I went and I parked in front of, I live now probably 20 minutes from where I grew up. I went and I parked in front of that childhood home. And I couldn't take my eyes off of it because I loved my home. I loved my family. I loved my childhood. And all of a sudden, it looked like a Walt Disney, like a looming, you know, evil home. It took on a real sinister hue.
And that's your point, that most of us are it's, this is so much a part of our lives, it goes unquestioned, and we don't even know about it. We don't even consider it as part of it. When you look at, you yourself looked at people and didn't understand why they couldn't make it in this country when they were given all these opportunities. You made it. Your parents made it. Why couldn't they? And because it's because we don't know.
And that was, you know, now I'm having a revelation right on the air. I think the big aha was the fact that there, I knew in the moment I learned that, I thought, this is a huge part of the problem. There are millions. I know many, many white people who would love to be a part of dismantling racism, who can't stand it, who can't stand any form of injustice. But you can't fight a problem or even engage in a problem if you don't understand it. And in the course, I was, you know, all these horrible depictions of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, I was seeing them on the news, and I thought, I don't really care about the bigots, but we also can't stay silent, because doing nothing is just perpetuating the system. And so that was when I got motivated to reach out to well-intentioned white people to say, wow, this isn't an impossible problem. It's actually understandable, and we can engage in it, and we can make a difference.
A couple of things have been coming in from listeners as we've been talking. Tom emails, I'm so glad to be hearing your conversation today as our church continues to wrestle with being an intentionally eclectic community. Those of us with white privilege have simply had to learn to lay down our pride and hear our brothers and sisters of color. I hope this conversation sparks more dialogue like ours around the city. Jolie emails, on MLK Day, my 5-year-old son asked me why he had the day off from school. I struggled to explain who Martin Luther King was and why he was important, not because I didn't know, but because I lacked the words to describe racism. I find his questions about sex so much easier to answer precisely because I have technical, precise language to use. I think I need to read Debbie's book. Would that be helpful for her?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's exactly. I talked about climate. We can talk about climate change. We can talk about nutrition. I'm going to start talking, say we can also talk about sex, but we can't talk about race because we don't have the language or the understandings. It is true. It's just, like I say, it's an epidemic of silence, and people are terrified to talk about it. It doesn't need to be scary. It's actually, Cornel West says, justice is love in public. Yeah, this is about loving one another. This is about living up to these ideals that we talk about often in our faith community.
But how can it not be scary, particularly if you are in the power seat, if you're the white person having this conversation and you feel or say things like your father said while watching television, boy, those black guys can play. They're great athletes. That got Jimmy the Greek fired from CBS. If you're a white person and you are airing these misconceptions, even if you're in a dialogue about trying to stamp out misconceptions, it brands you as somebody who is a bigot. How can you say these things and not be at risk?
I was going to say, Mike, I think this is it's such an important part of it because it is terrifying at times, and we see people, just paralyzed around this subject matter. And it's really kind of ironic when we have what they're calling the browning of America taking place, where we have an increasingly more diverse America coming upon us, but we have this kind of paralyzing state of mind when it comes to this subject matter. And so I think what we're trying to do in partnership with folks like Debbie, who's writing and putting together these kinds of projects, is present a space and place for that mom to be able to come and just stumble and trip and fall and be challenged and also challenge and learn, so that it's a skill set kind of building environment. And I think that that's really what is needed more often, is places like that church that groups of people can go and just stumble and trip and fall and struggle through some of the conversation. But it's an environment where it's about love, it's about care, it's about, genuinely building the kind of society that we want to have.
Is it equally scary on your side of the equation, Dr. Moore? I mean, it's scary for white people to voice some of the things that may be inside their heads, or things that their mother or father or grandmother or grandfather may have said about African Americans. It's scary for those people to say those things out loud. Is it equally scary for some black people to share their conception or their perceptions of white people?
Yeah, I think it's not only scary, but for me it's more painful and frustrating, because I feel like everywhere I go, especially when I was living in the Midwest, people would say, oh, what's it like to be a black man here? What's it like? And, I'd share that. And sometimes it was, challenging and troubling and painful kind of stuff. But I didn't feel like that was reciprocated. And so I think some of the things that I feel is frustration, where I feel like I'm trying to reach out to my white friends and colleagues and say, let's have this painful exchange, but I don't want to just tell you what it's like to be black. I want to hear what it's like to be white. I want to have an equal struggle in our sharing. Mine may be one of pain because I'm being presumed all this kind of stuff, whatever. But I'd like to know what it's like to be white as well. So I think for me, sometimes not only is it a little scary and I'm a little hesitant, but most of the time it's frustration, because I feel like I've poured all myself out at this session or at this opportunity for conversation, and the white person is somewhat sitting there hesitant and scared, which, again, I'm not saying is abnormal, but it feels like I've given 75% and they're giving 25%. So I have a feeling of frustration at times.
We have a skeptic in our midst. Will on Facebook says, is this really a talk about social stereotypes and social change, or is it just racial apologists trying to use the topic as a method to sell books? Doesn't moving past things mean not glorifying it? I surely have no clue what white privilege is. Last time I checked, I get speeding tickets, I pay taxes, I don't qualify for any government help. Please enlighten me.
Yeah, I would say there are some pancakes you'll never flip over. And there may be, this may be a case where that learning can't take place. But I feel like if you look statistically across any of the identifiers that we measure as a society, you will see some serious inequality. In fact, in many of those statistics, you see increasing inequalities. And I think that's what we're trying to look at. I'm not trying to flip a pancake that's not willing to be flipped.
But is that increasing inequality racial, or is it socioeconomic? In other words, there are a lot of white people, Asian people, Mexican Americans struggling in this economy.
I think I would say that it's both of those. I would say, depending on if you're looking at education, if you're looking at home ownership, if you're looking at bank loans, you're looking at mortgage rates. I mean, you can go on, particularly around things that impact people's bottom line in their homes, that those disparities are not only socioeconomic but also race-based.
I think it's fairly certain that there are a lot of people who do not understand, do not see white privilege, and perhaps would it be accurate to say that reading your book from a white person's point of view, they might discover that?
They would get a much deeper sense of what it's about, and I encourage skeptics to read it too. And like Eddie says, no one has to agree 100% with Debbie Irving, but at least talk about it. Let's talk
Debbie
about it.
Debbie Irving's book is Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Thank you for the hour, and Dr. Eddie Moore, the founder of the White Privilege Conference, thank you as well.